Good. Okay, so welcome back after the break. So, yes, so this is, I don't know if there's a, it's not penultimate, it's penultimate week on the tantric symbols, third last week. And, yeah, so we've been exploring symbols of tantric Buddhism, which is the third great sort of phase of Buddhism. It's also called the Vajrayana, or Diamond Way. And it particularly emphasizes direct experience, and it particularly communicates the Dharma through symbols rather than sort of mediated by concepts. And we've been using this book mainly, Creative Symbols of Tantric Buddhism by Bhante Sankaracharya. So that was a series of apparently electrifying lectures that he gave back in the day. And they were later edited into a book. When were they given? Probably in the 1980s or even 70s. I don't remember actually. Anyway, sometime about then. And tonight we're going to talk about the mandala of the five Buddhas, male and female. And so what I'll do is I'll say a bit in general about this notion of there being these five Buddhas. Not only that are there five of them, but each is in sort of male and female form, as it were. And then I'll probably pause after that and see if there's any questions. And then I'll talk about each of the five pairs of Buddhas individually. So, yeah, maybe just a tiny little bit about symbol. I mean, we've said quite a lot about symbol in general, and even if you haven't been, you can maybe listen back or have a look at the book. But another way of talking about symbol, and Bhante talks about it here, is he talks about it as a variety of interlocking patterns that unfold from within. So the sort of heart of the Tantra, the heart of Tantric Buddhism is this, are these interlocking patterns all unfolding. And he says that this particular subject, these five Buddhas, are the most important of all. Yeah? And unless we are familiar with this, then the other symbols won't make sense really. And it means really understanding, not just intellectually, yes, but also emotionally and dharmically as well. And then in turn to understand that, to understand the symbol of the five Buddhas, we have to go right back to the absolute fundamentals, and the absolute fundamental of Buddhism is the Buddha himself. And so it's worth spending just a little bit of time on really what are we talking about when we're talking about the Buddha? Who are we talking about when we're talking about the Buddha? Because it's for Western thought, particularly for Western thought at the time of these lectures, but probably still even really, the notion of Buddha. This word Buddha. This. I don't even want to say person in a way. Yeah, maybe just this Buddha is something completely new. So in kind of classical Western thought, we've got the concept of humanity, yeah, and we've got, or at least we had, the concept of God, and them being two separate things. But yeah, there was never any concept equivalent to Buddha. So it's almost like we've got to shift our whole way of thinking to accommodate that, or even accommodate isn't the right word. We've got to change our whole way of thinking. I've said this before at the classes, it's the same as true of actually many of the words that we have in Buddhism, like Shraddha meaning faith, or Vidya meaning aesthetic appreciation. All of these are just approximate translations. We can't we can't just translate them into English and think we know what they are, because actually it's a whole new way of thinking. They're untranslatable, and probably Buddha is untranslatable, really. It's like we've always got to get in a new way of mind to begin to understand what it means. This idea that a human being can become an embodiment of what we might call reality with a capital R by her or his own efforts gives us a whole new conception of the possibilities of human development that we've never had before. And it hadn't been envisaged before. And if we're not careful, we can just sort of map the Buddha onto something that we think we know. So perhaps if Christianity has been, even if we haven't been directly brought up as a Christian, if that's still the sort of, if we're still the remnants of that, we might think of the Buddha as a sort of oriental Jesus type character. Yeah. And that was certainly how Buddha was explained way back at the end of the 19th century, yeah, not the last century, but the 19th century. Or if you had a more sort of Hindu kind of frame of reference, then you might think of the Buddha as an incarnation of God, a sort of avatar, yeah? Or if you had a more humanistic frame of reference, you might think the Buddha is, you know, just simply a very good and wise person like Socrates, yeah? So, but none of these would actually be what the Buddha was, yeah? This difficulty in characterising the Buddha goes back to the time of the Buddha himself. So we've got the very well-known story of the very first person that the Buddha met after his enlightenment was a Brahmin called Dona, who tried to understand what kind of being the Buddha was. He obviously was struck by the person of the Buddha, probably looking very glowing and very, well, he was just enlightened, so we can only imagine what he might have looked like. And Dona is saying, "Are you a god? Are you a sort of spirit or sprite? Are you a man?" And each time the Buddha says, "No, I'm not a god, I'm not a spirit or sprite, I'm not a man." And eventually the Buddha says, though this is the sort of quote, "Those karmic tendencies on account of which I might have been placed in one of those categories have been exhausted. Yeah? Therefore, I am a Buddha." So the Buddha's, he was born a man, as we know, but he's gone beyond what we normally think of as human, because he's transcended all karma. He's transcended, I like this way Bhante puts it, all the individualising tendencies. When we're kind of governed by greed, hatred and delusion, what that means is we're just coming back to me all the time. We're just constantly circling back to what makes me me. And that's very, very important to us. Whether we think we love ourselves or hate ourselves or are indifferent to ourselves, it all circles back to me. Yeah? So that's the, I like that notion, it's the individualising tendencies. That has been brought to an end in the Buddha. So how are we going to describe him, actually? How are we going to describe him? He's still at this stage a historical figure, so he's still associated with the body, which is a product of all those tendencies, but that no longer represents him. Yeah? So here's what Sangharakshita says, and in a way, even this reduces it, but you can only do your best putting things into words. He says, in the notion of Buddha, humanity and the absolute coalesce. Now, we've got to be careful with this word absolute, because immediately you say that it sort of reifies something, and actually there is no such thing actually as the absolute, but we're just trying to talk about something that's beyond our usual circling round and round this, circling back to an I, yeah? So we take that in inverted commas, the absolute, and the notion of Buddha, humanity and the absolute coalesce. He says, in a sense, humanity ceases to be humanity as we understand the term. It doesn't mean that one's less than human, it means you've kind of gone outside the category of that altogether. And he says, at the same time, the absolute ceases to be the absolute in a merely abstract sense. It becomes realised, even embodied. Okay, that's enough to ponder on for like the rest of our lives for the start, probably. So and that's kind of what I'm hoping we can explore tonight. What does that mean? What does that mean that the humanity ceases to be humanity in the normal understanding of the term? It goes beyond it. Maybe that's a better way than saying it ceases even. Humanity goes beyond humanity in the normal sense. And the absolute ceases to be the absolute in a merely abstract sense. It becomes realised, even embodied, yeah? So, the tradition of Buddhism has got a sort of term that sort of seems to encapsulate all of this. So what we could say is that a Buddha is a human being who's attained Samyak Sambodhi. Yeah? Samyak Sambodhi. So Bodhi means awakening. Yeah? That's what it means. That's what Buddha means, really, awakening. And Samyak means supreme or perfect. So you've got Samyak Sambodhi, supreme, perfect awakening. And that Bodhi, this awakening, we can say it's got three main aspects, yeah? So it's got cognitive, volitional and emotional. And I was very interested actually hearing, you know, when I asked you all to talk about, well, what's the meaning of life for you? Because I think between us we've probably got these three aspects, cognitive, volitional and emotional, yeah? So I'll say a little bit about how Dante describes each of these. So, well, basically, from the cognitive point of view, you would say that Bodhi is a condition of insight, yeah? So it's a state of wisdom or awareness. It's the truth found, yeah? This is the truth actually found. So in the first place, Bhante says this awareness is awareness towards ourselves. So we fully and deeply understand ourselves, not just psychologically, although it would include that, but really seeing that we're conditioned on every level of our being, yeah? And that we're not free. While we're conditioned, we're not free. We're reacting mechanically, yeah? So we're not free. We're conditioned by stuff outside us and by our own internal things, yeah? Things that we kind of brought with us, as it were, and then things we've added on to that. So we're conditioned on every line of our being, and that means we're not free. And then that this cognitive aspect also sees that that's the same for everyone who's not enlightened, yeah? Which is most people. And then we see that actually it's all phenomena whatsoever, the whole of nature, the whole of conditioned existence, everything's conditioned. The universe itself is transitory, ever-changing. That gives rise to frustration and dukkha, yeah? But then when we look deeper and deeper and deeper, we see that in the depths of the transitory, we see the eternal, yeah? That in the depths of the unreal, we see the real. Yeah? If we keep sort of unflinchingly looking at this, if we don't just succumb to the temptation of covering up our unsatisfactoriness with, well, all the things we crave, if we don't succumb, if we don't flinch from from seeing we're not free, actually, we go right through that, as it were, we've got the chance of becoming free, yeah? And ultimately, this is the sort of baffling bit, we see the two, that is the unreal and the real, as different facets of one and the same reality. And that's just baffling to us, this side of enlightenment, because actually we can no longer put it between words. I mean, in a way I can say this, the unreal is the same as the real, but you know, what does it mean really? Words can't convey, Dante says, the profound nature of this experience. We can't, in a way, we can't experience it until we've got a fit mind and heart to experience it. So don't worry if it sounds baffling, because in a way it's meant to be, really. And anyway, words aren't enough, yeah? So Bodhi isn't just this state of knowledge, it has to have this volitional aspect as well, yeah? And in the volitional aspect, it's a state of complete freedom, yeah? Which is a subjective and objective both. So it's with freedom from all negative emotions and from the whole process of the reactive mind. Freedom from karma and rebirth, that no longer applies in a way, where the Buddha's talked about as the trackless one, you're not leaving any tracks anymore. And more positively, it's the state of uninterrupted creativity and spontaneity, and which I love actually, that description that Bodhi as creativity. And then it's got the emotional aspect as well. It's a state of positive emotion, subjectively, as where's Sam? Joy, bliss, happiness, ecstasy, yeah? And also objectively, as I think a number of people said, love and compassion for all human beings, yeah? So basically, these are the attempts to describe Bodhi, yeah? It's a state of full insight into self and others, into conditioned and unconditioned. It's a state of absolute freedom, liberation within and objective freedom, and it's a state of complete supreme bliss, and also infinite love and unbounded compassion. And they're all the same thing in a way. It's not, they're all, that would all be all simultaneous, all those things, yeah? And yes, so a Buddha is a human being who's attained, for want of a better word, this state, the human embodiment of insight, freedom, happiness, and love. So far so good, hopefully. That's an attempt to say enlightenment, so I'll say a little bit more, and then I'll pause. So, and that was embodied in a person, and first of all in the person of the Buddha, and then his followers, not just his immediate followers, his disciples, but his followers through the ages. The other people became enlightened. Other people didn't become a Buddha in the same way, because the Buddha, by definition, is the first to awake. Yes, so in a way he was the first, so that's why he's the Buddha. But other people became enlightened. But there's a distinction that the Buddha himself drew between an enlightened human individual and the principle of enlightenment, yeah? Between Buddha and Buddhahood. And this is a really important distinction, as we'll see. And there were some terms then coined to describe that. So it came to be that the enlightened human historical personality, that was given the term Nirmanakaya, yeah? And the principle of enlightenment, as sort of independent of the person realizing it, was known as the Dharmakaya, the body of truth or reality, yeah? So you've got the Buddha form, the Nirmanakaya. Kaya means body. And then you've got the Dharmakaya, the body of reality. Bani says something quite interesting here, which I don't even fully understand myself. I'll need to ponder upon it. He says, note that this is a distinction, not a difference. Yeah? There's a distinction between the Nirmanakaya and the Dharmakaya, but there's not a difference. Both the form body and the Dharma body were both bodies of the Buddha, in a sense. Yeah? So in the time when the Buddha was alive, there was that distinction, but in a sense it didn't really matter very much, the distinction, because, you know, you had the Buddha, so, you know, you had the historical Buddha, so the Nirmanakaya and Dharmakaya were united, literally, because you had the Buddha with you, as it were, if you were a disciple. But after the Parinirvana, the passing away of the Buddha, well, then you've got a distinction between the form body and the Dharma body, haven't you? So the form body, the flesh is gone. You could even say dead. We don't usually talk about the Buddha as having died, because all that's died is the form, yeah? But the Dharma body was eternally present. According to Bhante, after the Buddha's Parinirvana, as during his lifetime. Yeah? So then there's just one more bit before I pause. So what you get then over time, as you move into the first, so there's the first great phase of Buddhism, which is when the Buddha was, you know, in living memory of his disciples. Then you've got the second phase, the Mahayana, then the third phase, the Vajrayana. So by the time it comes to the Mahayana, you know, you can imagine them sort of thinking you've got this kind of vertical axis, as it were. So you've got the form body, kind of, say, here. That's in time, in actual historical time in the past. And then you've got the Dharma body as above, being out of time, transcending time. So you've got this kind of vertical relationship between the enlightened individual, the form body, and the principle of enlightenment. But then at this really important bit, and this is going to be the gist of the rest of the evening, happens, which is you've got, in a way, a third kaya appears. So you've got this Nirmanakaya, this Dharmakaya, and the third kaya is in between the other two. And this eventually was known as the Sambhogakaya, which means body of mutual delight or mutual enjoyment. That's the literal translation, but Bhante says it's more helpful than, I think we'll see why he says this, as the ideal Buddha or the archetypal Buddha. So this ideal Buddha isn't abstract like the Dharmakaya. At the same time, he's not a historical individual like the Nirmanakaya. Yeah? So it's the ideal person, the archetypal person. So you've got this alignment of the three. Yeah? And what is really interesting about all this is, so in a way you could say that the Sambhogakaya is the mythical Buddha, but that's grown out of history. You get that all the time in Buddhism, that the actual lived experience comes first, and then the myth comes later. I feel like this has become more and more important to me and my own kind of thinking and thinking about the Dharma, that Buddhism doesn't start with an idea. It doesn't even start with a myth. I think so many religions start with a myth. They start with the story and then the working out comes later. But Buddhism starts with the actual lived experience of the Buddha, an actual person with an existential imperative to go forth and find the truth, and finds the truth and lives and teaches and passes away, and then the myth grows directly out of that. So you've got it that way round. Yeah, you haven't you're not starting with a myth, you're not starting with an abstract teaching that then you've got to try and have faith in or not. Yeah? You're starting with something lived experience that actually we can relate to. You know, very, very kind of very kind of touched and struck by just by, you know, in a way asking you to do that exercise and just spend a few minutes on it, that people could come up with, you know, with these really meaningful quests, you know, that we're all, that, you know, which, and that was, you know, our experience can therefore relate to the Buddha's experience as a person. So he comes first, the myth comes later, not the other way around. So that means that, you know, again, it comes back to this thing where in the Dharma, we're not kind of asked to believe in something on kind of blind faith and then sort of try and do the working out. It all kind of just sort of emerges naturally out of kind of lived experience. So maybe I'll just pause briefly there. So is there any... I don't mind if there's no questions, but I will just pause because I've said quite a lot. I have got quite... There's more now to say about the five Buddhas. But is there any questions or on what I've said so far? Any questions of clarification?
Yes. Sort of stems from a discussion I had with my friends about Buddhism, where I sort of say, so sort of this has gone on, where some religions start with myth, and then you have the unfolding. But they seem to believe that Buddhism is no different with the myth than, you see what I'm saying? It's like, so what makes you so sure that Buddhism didn't start with a myth then, as opposed to, like, for some other religions, maybe, like, I don't know, Christianity, would you say, was myth-based into story, as opposed to Buddhism being experienced into story? You see what I'm saying?
So is your question, what makes me so sure that Buddhism doesn't start with a myth, or what? Well, I guess the historical account of the Buddha, and I suppose, although, like, even if, I do happen to believe that it's a true historical account, but even if it wasn't literally true, it still feels, it still could be true. You know, just this idea of a young man or a young person thinking, God, this, is this really what life's about? Can life really be just about pleasure, but then we're all going to die, and I'm just going to sit here and not do anything about it? That feels so close to my own experience that it's, that that's believable. So that's convincing to me, that it comes from actual experience, and then anything that's mythical comes later. I don't know how else to say it, really. So that convinces me, because I know what it's like to have that quest, and in a way the practices have served to heighten that quest in me. I had a glimmering of it before I ever meditated or so on, but the more I meditated, the more urgent that's felt. So it's got, that's what gives that the ring of truth to me.
I can see what you're saying. I mean, I suppose where I'm coming from is, in a sense, like, I sort of, like, when I look into other religions, so let's say my friend is part of Islam, I have a Christian friend, and like, it almost seems like a lot of the qualities are almost universal when it comes to, like, compassion being, like, the sort of main focus of, with religion, in a sense. I suppose the way I'm saying is that it almost seems like, what I'm trying to get at is sort of like Buddhism seems to be one route to the greater whole, whereas Christianity is as well, and Islam, Judaism, it almost seems to be the same. I don't know, now I'm getting kind of lost in my head.
Now that's a different question. That's different. But I think the thing you'd have to ask, if you say they've all got the same goal, you'd have to say, what is the goal? And actually, I would not say that the goal is the same, although some of the expressions, like compassion, for example, might look the same, I think the goal of Buddhism is particular.
Mm.
And what leads to that particular goal is what we call Buddhism.
Mm.
What leads to, whereas the goal of other religions is not the same goal, although some of the practices may be the same, because they're universal values.
Okay.
Or else why would we bother, in a way, to define, you know,
yeah.
If you told your Islamic friend, oh, you're a Buddhist, actually, I don't know what they'd think. I think that's I think it's an interesting question that comes up again and again, but I think that's a different question. I think that's a different question again about the goal, because this is more about the beginning I'm talking about. I'm saying, just connect up, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, you are. Yeah. Okay, should I carry on a bit? So what we're saying is, what I'm keen to say is that, because in a minute I'm going to talk about myth, but what Banji's stressing is the myth naturally arises out of the historical, yeah? So, yeah, is that all right to carry on? And I'll tell you about these five Buddhas. So, one of the first and earliest illustrations of the way that myth grew out of the historical is this mandala of the five Buddhas, yeah? So first of all, as we've seen, you've got the Buddha, Shakyamuni, and he, well, as we know, meditated under the Bodhi tree. Just before his enlightenment, he called the earth goddess to witness, didn't he, by touching the earth. And the earth goddess witnessed all his skillful action through the ages, thus kind of confirming his right to sit there and attain enlightenment. And then the Buddha went on teaching, both formally teaching, but also just responding with kind of infinite compassion to his disciples and to the world. Yeah. And then out of that, these more mythologized forms of the Buddha appeared. Yeah. And the Buddha appeared, as it were, probably first of all in the minds of people meditating on the Buddha, in different forms, different colours, with different mudras or hand gestures, with different adornments and so on, you know, that might represent him meditating under the tree, you know, so some people in their mind, when they thought of the Buddha, would see him meditating under the tree. Some people would, in their mind, when they thought of the Buddha after he passed away, would see him teaching and walking about and so forth. And eventually, these were depicted in forms. They would be visionary forms, and then there would be that kind of pressing urge in people to try and create those forms in actuality. So, you know, you might imagine... you know, sometimes it might not be literally like this, but this is how I like to imagine it, that, you know, the Buddha's passed away, maybe there's a last few people, old men and women, that just about remember the Buddha, and some younger people are saying, what was he like? What was the Buddha like? And what that one person would say, oh, he was just so kind, you know, remember when Kisagotami's baby died, he was just so kind to her. And some of us would say, God, he was absolutely fearless. Remember when he met that bandit, he just was totally, there was no fear in him. And some of us would have said, gosh, he was full of energy. You know, sometimes it looked like he had flames around him. He was so kind of, you know, there was so much energy coming off him. And some of us would have said, gosh, he was so peaceful, you know, when you were with him, even if you were agitated, you just felt this peace just radiating. You know, so and they would all describe him in different ways. And probably those ways would be, they would kind of correspond to the person, like, you know, to the person, Because that's what we're like, aren't we? If we kind of long for courage, you know, we might see that in another person. If we, so it would also resonate with us what we'd remembered, you know. And you know, that happens with even more ordinary people, you know, doesn't it? You know, I'm saying maybe, you know, maybe like by seeing a peel one day, people would be saying, "What was he like?" And like, and somebody would say, "Oh, he was." Like, he was so kind, and somebody else, I said, but yeah, but he was kind, but remember that day he gave the lecture and he was really on fire, you know. So different people will remember different, you know, that's what we're like, and that's because that'll strike a chord with us. It works, what we see in other people is because it strikes a chord with us. What strikes a chord with us, we'll long to see. And then you can imagine, that, you know, that's how these disciples would see the Buddhas in their mind's eye, and then there would come, you know, you'd think, maybe one of them would think, God, I wonder, you know, I probably can't do it, but I'll just try and paint that form. And then they would try and paint it, and they would think, oh, you know, I just couldn't get it, you know, maybe just a little, maybe I got that little bit just right, you know, but all the rest of it, I couldn't quite do it justice. Or they try and, you know, depict it in sculpture or even music or something, and they'd always be dissatisfied because you could never, but it would be, and they'd want to do it again, you know. And then other people would see the forms, and maybe they'd think, oh, actually, yeah, you've got the hand gesture just right. That's how I saw the Buddha too, you know, and it would spark off other people. So these forms, the sort of myth of the Buddha, would become a living thing, yeah? So out of that, first of all, emerged a set of five Buddhas, you know, with five different hand gestures, five different colours. And so the whole idea of Buddhahood was raised to a more ideal or archetypal level, sort of getting richer and more multifaceted, even, multidimensional. So you had this mandala or pattern of five Buddhas. This was one of the first things that emerged. After that, there were more and more hundreds of archetypal Buddhas. This is a primary one. So in the middle, you've got, first of all, the primary Buddha. And then first of all, to his right and left, were the Buddhas of the east and west. And they represented wisdom and compassion. And what you can say, the intellectual and the emotional aspects of Buddhahood, yeah? The cognitive and then the emotional. And then later on, and especially with Tantric Buddhism, the third phase, you had the Buddhas of the north and the south. So they represented the further aspects of enlightenment, compassionate action and beauty. So now you've got five, one at the centre and one at each of the cardinal points. And they're called the five jinnas, or the five conquerors, yeah? And so what they're trying to do is communicate something of the multifaceted nature of enlightenment. They're trying to bring it out as nature more explicitly so you can see it more clearly. Like if you just say enlightenment, you can think, oh, but yeah, what does that actually mean? But if you start saying, oh, it means... yeah, forever unfolding creativity, you maybe start to get more of a flavour of it. It means like complete beauty, you know, beauty that you've never known before. You know, you really know what beauty really is when you encounter it. Yeah, so you can see it more clearly. So you've got these five Buddhas. And then there's a later development again. So you've got these five of the five female Buddhas, yeah? So, and these are often, I was trying to find a picture of it, but you often sort of see them, the male and female, they're in sexual union. Yeah, see, that's the Tantra. You've got the male and female in sexual union. I'm sure you've seen pictures of this. And sex is here as a symbol, yeah. So this is what we're dealing with all the time in the Tantra. So it's not sex in the literal sense; it's sexual symbolism, which is a totally different thing. Yeah. a totally different thing. So, I'll just ask you, what do you think the Tantra is trying to express by this symbolism of a male and female figure in this kind of union?
No idea.
What's that?
So, well, it's some sort of ecstasy or something, surely. It's saying it's a bit like an orgasm.
I don't think that's what it means. I think it can seem like that, but I don't think that is what it means here. It means something more simple, yeah.
I've always been a bit sceptical at this point. I've got to say where they go, oh yeah, it's like a lady sitting on him.
Yeah.
It's nothing to do with sex.
It's very hard, isn't it? Because that's what we're conditioned to think, isn't it? It's very, you know, it is very, It's very, and in a way that's why I was quite kind of, because we've all seen those images, and the Tantra does sometimes talk about this kind of, it does talk about bliss and so on, but it sort of simply means here that wisdom and compassion are not separate. So that's what it simply means. So you've got the sort of female, sort of part, as it were, I don't know what to say, as wisdom, and the male as compassion. And male and female are symbols, so it's not like a literal man and woman anymore at all, actually. It's the active compassion and the receptive wisdom, the sort of intuitive, deep intuition of wisdom. So it's that they're completely inseparable. That's what that symbol means. Shame I haven't got a picture, but I'm sure you've all seen them.
So kind of like a yin yang.
The yin yang, and then the Chinese, it was called yab yong in Tibetan. So it's the inseparability of them. So karuna, compassion, and pranya, wisdom. One will naturally lead to the other. So, sort of wisdom cannot help but be expressed in compassion. When we realise insight, that will naturally express itself in compassion. You actually can't have one without the other. So, you've got this, completely close, even ecstatic union. So, I think it's not wrong to use the word ecstasy, because you've got this ecstatic union, but it isn't really the same as sexual ecstasy.
Are they saying it's a metaphor, though? Are they saying, sexual ecstasy is like a metaphor for spiritual ecstasy? Is that fair to say?
Well, that would be one way of saying it. I think maybe you're on safer ground if you think of that absolute union. I think of it as completely symbolic of a union,
And is this sort of a Tibetan thing?
So the Vajrayana Vajrayana, but which particularly is practiced in Tibet. And most of the images we see are Tibetan. The images we see. That's another thing we've got to just be a little bit careful of that, because most of the forms we see are Tibetan. We need to be careful we don't just go down that track and think that that is what these figures would look like, because actually we don't. They're just an attempt by, in this case, Tibetans, to give form to something that's much deeper than form. I mean, eventually, we hope, if Buddhism really takes root in the West, there'll be new forms. But even they won't be it, Even they won't be it. When we really, we can meditate on these figures. We can meditate on, say, the Buddha of compassion. Even kind of visualising a form in our mind. But we'd be mistaken to think that form is the Buddha. When the Buddha really does appear to us, it will be totally different than anything we can even imagine, because it's beyond our imagination just now.
I don't mean to be too discursive, but I read somewhere this essay about, sort of saying that one of the reasons they made these very beautiful images in the book was, if you can imagine, sort of back in the day, you've got a bunch of monks and they're kind of going into this village and they want to sort of tell them about Buddhism. You've got a big statue, this very beautiful sort of androgynous figure. It's kind of a bit like a sort of salesman thing in a way. It's kind of, you know, the first thing is like, well, we're talking about this guy and he's this amazing, beautiful chap.
Well, and that's true. Yeah. That's true even today. The figures are deliberately attractive so that we would want to meditate on them.
Yeah.
It's not just the monks, you know, so we'd want to meditate on them.
Yeah.
So I'll tell you these five figures, and if you want to find out more about them, then I really recommend, well, both this book, and then there's a book by an ordinary member called Visantra, who's written a book called Meeting the Buddhas, which goes into this whole symbolism even more. But I'll just briefly go through in the last few minutes this mandala of the five Buddhas, male and female. So in the centre, you have the Buddha Virochana and his consort, Akasha Dateshvari. Yeah? So already, so Virochana means illuminator, Akasha means space. But as we talked about a few weeks ago, it's not the literal space, it's the space we enter in the meditative mind. So you, again, I love this, you can notion then of that union. You see that light and space are entwined, yeah? That light and space are the same thing. That kind of space would be illuminated, and it's almost like a dance then of emptiness and light. Emptiness, of course, meaning fullness rather than an absence, yeah? And he's the central figure, and she's the central figure. She's often depicted like a Dakini, like with her wild hair, you know, the sort of abandon. And he's in teaching mudra. But more and more, I think, even this idea of him teaching is maybe a bit, would have more life in it. What he's showing is that if we look deeply enough, everything is dharma. Everything's kind of quivering with light and dharma. Sometimes you might get very, very glimpse of this if you're on retreat. You know, after you meditate and you just walk out and everything's alive, you know. Everything's alive. That's a kind of glimpse of that sort of wisdom that's embodied by Virochana and his consort, Akasha Dateshvari. Her name is Queen of the Sphere of Infinite Space. Yeah? So, and then you've got the Buddha of Wisdom, who is Akshobhya, and his consort Lochana. So he's touching the earth, and actually she's touching the earth as well, which harks back to the historical Buddha touching the earth. And I meant to say Akshobhya. So Akshobhya means imperturbable. And so you've got this sense of, just something unshakable. And then Lochana means the one with the eye. Yeah, so you've got that she's the all-seeing, and you've got them as a pair. Yeah, so again, that's wisdom and compassion as a pair. And then you've got the Buddha on the sort of opposite. You've got the Buddha of love, Amitabha. This is how Amitabha sits in meditation. The red Buddha. I forgot to say Akshobhya and Lochana are both blue. Amitabha is red, and he's seated in meditation, and he's particularly representing love and compassion. That's why he's red. And his consort is Pandaravasini, and her name means the white-robed one. So you've got this lovely image of being protected by a white robe. of our Dharma practice protects us. It's an image for meditation as well, and the higher states of meditation. And right back in the Buddha's time, the Buddha himself described deep meditation as like a person who, on a hot summer's day, like dives into some refreshing water and then comes out and wraps themselves in a white towel. So the Buddha described that as an image for meditation, and then that's become the myth of Pandaravasini. So again, you've got this link between the historical and the myth. And she's the consort of Amitabha, the Buddha of love and meditation. And then you've got the Buddha of the south, who is Ratnasambhava. So he's the Buddha of generosity and abundance. So his mudra is holding his hand out in supreme giving. And his consort is Mamaki. So his Ratnasambhava means the jewel-born one, so that's got that whole connotation of abundance. The jewels just kind of pour out, as it were. He's born of jewels and he gives jewels. And then Mamaki, her name, it's a lovely meaning, this. It means mine maker. So she makes everything her own, not in a grasping sense, but it's like she cherishes everything as if it was her very own. So every person, every project, even, you could say, she really gives it her full attention, and doesn't discriminate, doesn't kind of think, oh, this person's more important than that person to love, as it were. She just made everything as her own. So again, this ties in with the generosity. So you've got the generosity and the mine maker. She makes everything her own. And then finally, in the north, you have Amoghasiddhi. So he is, Ratnasambhava and Mamaki are yellow, and then Amoghasiddhi is green, and he's holding his hand up in the gesture of fearlessness. And again, one of the most famous historical incidents in the Buddha's life, this harks back to, is when the Buddha does beat the serial killer, mass murderer, and Gulimala. But he isn't afraid, and by his fearlessness, he converts Angulimala. In a way, that gesture is holding his hand up, like the Buddha in our small shrine room is. He's saying that actually, ultimately, there is nothing to fear, because there's nothing to protect. When you're a Buddha, you realise that everything you thought you had to protect, you don't have to protect, because there's just this constant flow of spontaneity. There's nothing to protect, so then you're truly fearless. And his consort is Green Tara, so she's probably the most famous, if that's the right word you can use about a Buddha, but she's also green in colour. She also holds her hand up in that fearlessness gesture, and she sits with one leg in meditation and one leg stepping down into the world. So she said to always come when called. Yeah? So she responds to the cries of the world. And she's very, you know, she's got a whole kind of, you know, like a massive, very, very strong devotion is displayed towards her. She's got a massive following, as it were, like many, many disciples of this archetypal Buddha, Green Tara. So that's the five Buddhas and their consorts. And they all, I hope you can see that they all sort of grew out of the Buddha. Yeah, they all grew out of the historical Buddha, but they all give different facets of enlightenment. And just as we all respond in different ways to different qualities, these Buddhas are there to, and if you like, meet that response. So if fearlessness is an important quality for you, you know, you can meditate on the Buddha of fearlessness, either Tara or Amoghasiddhi. If generosity is, then you can meditate on Ratnasambhava and Mamaki. So that's the symbolism of the five Buddhas, male and female, and their union showing that wisdom and compassion are completely inseparable. It's impossible to have one without the other. Yeah, that's what the symbolism is. It makes no sense to talk about wisdom without compassion in the Buddhist context, or it isn't wisdom. It makes no sense to think of compassion without wisdom, or it isn't compassion. So you need the both, and that's what that tantric symbol is showing us as a symbol. So that is all we've got time for tonight. I'm sorry I didn't have more time for questions as ever. And next week we're going to explore more on the symbolism of the stupa. And Simpi is going to lead that evening. So that's it for tonight. Thank you.